You're listening to DTFHN for April 27th, 2026. I'm your electromagnetically flipped host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue about how to build things. Today's got that restless workshop energy. Sawdust still settling from something nobody asked you to make. Let's get into it. In 2000, Soli Soli split. Sleepless is, were, the heartbeat of every major train station in Europe. Thousands of little mechanical tabs clacking in sequence, telling you where the next train was headed. They worked, they were beautiful, and one by one, they got ripped out and replaced with LCD screens that nobody loves. The logic was always the same. Newer means better. Digital means progress. But anyone who's stood in a train station squinting at a washed-out LED board in direct sunlight knows that's not universally true. Flip decks are the stubborn survivors of that same lineage. 80 years old is a technology, electromagnetically flipping small discs between two colors, and still doing something no modern screen can replicate. There's a term in architecture called honest materials. When stone looks like stone and wood looks like wood, when the material doesn't pretend to be something else, flip decks are honest pixels. They exist physically in the room with you. They catch ambient light instead of generating their own. And when they flip, they make this sound. Like rain on glass. That reminds you something mechanical is actually happening. This project is a 3x3 grid of Alpha Zeta panels. 84x42 disks, driven by machine learning for voice and video processing. The builder paired with their partner to design and code it. Quality hacking time with your partner. That sentence alone is worth celebrating. But pull this thread and you find the friction. The panels were on ABMega 128 microcontrollers with closed firmware. Sourcing components is difficult because the industry caters to transportation businesses, not individual makers. 9 panels will run you around $5,000 before you buy a single wire nut. The builder themselves said if they did it again, they'd design their own board. Specifically because having access to the firmware would help tune performance. That instinct is exactly right. When the tool doesn't let you inside, you're always working around it instead of with it. The comments are full of people with flip disc panels sitting in basements, half finished. Artists like Breakfast have built stunning kinetic installations with them. There's clearly demand and creative energy here. What's missing is accessible, open hardware that lets a broader community of tinkerers actually participate. The technology is 80 years old. The patents expired decades ago. The fact that it's still this hard to source and this expensive to build with is a distribution problem, not an engineering problem. Someone's going to design an open source flip disk board with modern microcontrollers and published firmware. And when they do, these things are going to be everywhere. The honest pixel deserves an honest supply chain. Moving on. When I was building my first social app, years ago, small team, no budget. We spent weeks on the friend request flow. Add button, confirm button, pending state, notification, acceptance, the whole ritual. And every time we watched someone use it, they'd fumble. Not because the UI was bad, but because the social contract was awkward. Asking someone to be your digital friend while you're standing right next to them felt redundant. The phone was getting in the way of the human moment. That memory hit me when I read about what's happening with Friendster. Yes, that Friendster. Someone bought the domain for $30,000. Negotiated down from 40, partially in trade, and is rebuilding it from scratch. Not as nostalgia bait. Not as a Web3 grift. As an actual social network built on one radical constraint, the only way to add a friend is to physically tap your phones together. Let's follow that design decision to its logical extreme. If proximity is the only entry point, you cannot add someone you've never met. You cannot be suggested friends by an algorithm. You cannot build a network of strangers performing friendship for engagement metrics. Every connection in the graph represents a real moment where two humans were in the same room and chose to link up. The entire growth hacking playbook. Viral invites, suggested connections, imported contacts. All of it becomes structurally impossible. That's either the most elegant constraint in social software design or a death sentence for growth. Probably both, and that tension is exactly what makes it worth watching. The engineering choice matters here too. Some commenters are pushing for a PWA with QR codes instead of a native app with NFC. And I get the pragmatism. Nobody wants to install another app. Web apps have broader reach, but there's something to be said for the physicality of the tap. QR codes are visual. Taps are haptic. The medium shapes the interaction. A tap feels like a handshake. A QR scan feels like a transaction. The Friendster name itself is a fascinating artifact. It predates Facebook, predates the social graph as we know it. Buying it for $30,000 and turning it into an experiment in constrained social design. That's builder culture at its best. You don't need permission. You don't need venture backing. You need a domain, a thesis, and enough stubbornness to ship something people might not immediately understand. The interesting question isn't whether this scales. It's whether the constraint reveals something true about how we actually want to connect. Something the algorithmic networks have been optimizing away from for 15 years. Now for something completely different, and I mean completely, Bob Odenkirk has thoughts on the fundamental absurdity of existence. One commenter nailed it in a single line, quote, "When the zeitgeist is overwhelmingly nihilist, dare to be an absurdist." That stopped me cold, because this isn't really about Bob Odenkirk. This is about what you do after you've stared into the void and the void got boring. Odenkirk's been making this argument with his entire career. From Mr. Show to Saul Goodman to now, apparently, saying it out loud in the New York Times. Life is a meaningless farce. And several commenters pushed back immediately. One pointed out that existential whimsy hits different when you're rich and successful versus when you're grinding through actual suffering. That's a fair critique. Privilege buffers the fall when you leap into the absurd. But here's where I want to pull a thread that the comments only graze. On August 25, 1991, a 21-year-old Finnish student posted to a Usenet group, quote, "I'm doing a free operating system, just a hobby, won't be big and professional." Linus Torvalds wasn't trying to save the world. He wasn't on a mission. He was scratching an itch, building something because the act of building was its own justification. 35 years later, Linux runs essentially everything. Every Android phone, every cloud server, the International Space Station. The most consequential operating system in history started as a hobby project by someone who, by his own admission, wasn't aiming at meaning. That's absurdism with a compiler. The commenter who wrote about thinking too much. About how if you survive the questioning, you land somewhere constructive. They're describing what every open source contributor discovers eventually. You don't build because the universe cares. You build because building is the response. The code doesn't need cosmic justification. It needs to compile. What Odenkirk articulates through comedy, builder culture articulates through shipping. Both are staring at the same void. One writes jokes, the other writes commits. Neither pretends the void isn't there. Both refuse to let it be the last word. The craft itself is the answer. Not the outcome, not the skill, not the market cap, the engineering, the writing, the thing you make because your hands needed something to do and your mind needed somewhere to go. Another commenter quoted Bill Hicks. Life as an amusement park ride that feels real because our minds are that powerful. What's beautiful about open systems is they let everyone design their own ride. Closed systems tell you the ride is the only option and charge you for the seat. Absurdism isn't nihilism. Nihilism says nothing matters, so why bother? Absurdism says nothing matters, so you're free. Free to build, free to ship, free to put tools where other people can reach them. Not because it saves the world, but because the making was always the point. And the making is very much the point in story 4. Someone just built a full audio DSP engine on a $4 microcontroller. What does a digital audio processor actually need to do? Strip away the brushed aluminum chassis, the proprietary software suite, the $300 price tag. At the silicon level, what are the requirements? You need to receive a digital audio stream. You need to apply mathematical transformations to that stream in real time. You need to output the result. That's it. That's the entire job description. The RP2040. The chip inside a Raspberry Pi Pico costs about a dollar in quantity. It has two ARM Cortex M0 Plus cores, some programmable I/O state machines, and enough RAM to hold a meaningful audio pipeline. A developer who goes by Weeb Labs looked at that spec sheet and saw a complete audio DSP platform waiting to be written. DSP-I is the firmware that proves it. Plug a Pico into any USB port and it enumerates as a sound card. No drivers on Mac, Windows, Linux, or iOS. Behind that USB interface sits a full signal processing chain. Parametric EQ with up to 10 bands per channel. Matrix mixing, active crossover capability, loudness compensation following the ISO 226 equal loudness contour standard. Headphone crossfeed based on the BS2B algorithm. Room correction. Time alignment. The entire toolkit that audiophiles spend hundreds or thousands of dollars to access through commercial DSP units. The RP2350 variant pushes it further. 8 output channels. 110 filter bands. A hybrid state variable and B-quad filter architecture for better accuracy in the low frequencies where B-quad coefficients sum to start to lose precision. That's not a toy implementation. That's someone who understands the actual numerical limitations of fixed point DSP and engineered around them. Pull this down to first principles and the economics are almost absurd. A $4 microcontroller board, some firmware, and a cheap I2S DAC gives you a room correction system that rivals dedicated hardware costing 50 times more. The firmware is on GitHub. The DAC are commodity parts. Every piece of this stack is open, replaceable, documented. The creator's stated hope is that the RP204 and RP2350 become known as the Swiss Army knife of audio for less than a cup of coffee. Given what this firmware already does, that reputation seems earned. The tools exist. The schematics are published. Anyone with a soldering iron and a free afternoon can build a professional-grade audio processor from parts that cost less than lunch. We talked earlier about tools that amplify what humans can do. Story 5 takes that idea somewhere deeper, pause into how we think. Every engineer I know has had this moment. You're deep in a code base, you throw a problem at your AI assistant. It hands back something that compiles, passes the tests, looks clean, and for about 30 seconds you feel like a genius. Then someone asks you why you chose that approach, and you realize you have no idea. You just accepted the first plausible thing that came back. Koshi John, writing from conversations with engineering leadership across the industry, frames this as a split. Two groups emerging. One uses AI to eliminate the tedious parts and reinvest that time into harder thinking. The other uses AI to skip the thinking entirely, and he argues correctly that the second path is a dead end. But let me play devil's advocate for a moment. What if outsourcing your thinking is actually fine? What if the whole point of tools is to not have to understand what they do? Nobody understands how their car's transmission works, and they drive just fine. Here's why that analogy falls apart. Driving is a closed problem. The transmission does the same thing every time. Software engineering is an open problem. Every code base is different. Every failure mode is novel. Every production incident is a snowflake of misery. The person who has been copying AI output for 2 years hits their first real outage, and they're standing there with a 1,000-yard stare because they never built the mental model of how any of it actually works. They skipped the reps. One commenter put it beautifully. They said using AI well is actually more exhausting than programming the old way. You pose a problem, evaluate proposals, pick the right one, watch it fail, iterate. That's not laziness, that's supervision, that's judgment, that's the job. The real comedy here is that AI tools are genuinely incredible at the boring parts. Boilerplate, refactoring, test scaffolding, documentation. The stuff that eats your afternoon and teaches you nothing. Offloading that work is pure gain. But the moment you let the tool do your reasoning, you've made yourself the boilerplate. You're the part that gets automated next. The engineers who thrive will be the ones who use AI the way HS Grandmaster uses an engine, not to pick their moves, but to explore deeper lines than they could calculate alone. The tool amplifies. It doesn't replace. And if you've been letting it replace, the gap between what you appear to know and what you actually know is growing every single day. That debt compounds silently until it doesn't. Moving on. Let me make the case against this. Documentation screenshots are a cosmetic concern. Users skim help pages. They rarely notice when a button moved 2 pixels left or a color shifted slightly. The ROI on automating screenshot capture for a help center is, by any reasonable product metric, close to zero. You could spend that engineering time on features that move revenue. That's the argument, and it's the argument that wins in most sprint plannings at most companies. And it is completely wrong. Here's why. The slow decay of documentation is one of those problems that never triggers an alert, never shows up in a dashboard, never gets a ticket. But it erodes trust continuously. A user opens a help article, sees a screenshot that doesn't match what's on their screen, and a small doubt forms. Maybe the instructions are outdated too. Maybe this whole product is held together with tape. That doubt compounds across every stale image on every page, and you will never see it in your analytics because the user just closes the tab and figures it out themselves. Or doesn't. What James built here is deceptively simple in concept. Markdown files with embedded screenshot instructions. A rake task that fires up headless Chrome, navigates to each page, clicks buttons, waits for animations, captures elements by CSS selector, crops, applies effects, and writes the images back. One command. Every screenshot current. Every help page honest. The tools underneath this are worth naming. Capybara, Cupwright, Headless Chrome, Red Carpet, Rails. Every layer of this stack is open. Every component is something another developer can pick up, study, extend, or rebuild for their own context. And the author did exactly what builder culture asks of you. Built something genuinely useful, then wrote up how it works in enough detail that you could replicate it tomorrow. One commenter called it a meme. Quote, "The neatest thing I've built that nobody will ever notice. But that framing sells it short. The infrastructure that nobody notices is the infrastructure that's working. The screenshot that matches the UI is invisible. The one that doesn't is a crack in the foundation. This is craft. Quiet, unglamorous, compounding craft. The kind that keeps software honest long after the feature ship." What happens when you apply that same first principles rigor, not to screenshots, but to quantization itself? Story 7, Turbo Quant. Buried in the comments of one of the most beautifully crafted math explainers I've seen this year, someone drops this. "I feel like I've gotten really good at noticing which model generates what type of site, and this oozes codex." Pause on that. An A, I built an interactive tutorial teaching you how to compress AI. The snake is eating its own tail. And the tail tastes pretty good. The page itself is a first principles walkthrough of TurboQuant, a vector quantization method for shrinking model weights. It starts with what a vector is, literally an arrow in space, and walks you through inner products, mean squared error, bias rotations, all the way up to the quantization scheme itself. Every concept gets a draggable interactive demo. You move the arrow, you watch the numbers change, you feel the math in your hands. One reader said it made mathematics 10 times more accessible. They're underselling it. This is what bootstrapism looks like when it's working. Not a paper behind a paywall, not a lecture you need university credentials to attend. A web page, free, interactive, runs in your browser. The color palette works in light mode and dark mode. Someone in the comments noticed that, which tells you the craft goes deeper than the content. Now here's where the story folds in on itself. Other commenters point out that TurboQuant is a restricted version of Eden quantization from NURBS 21. Lacks the optimal scale derivations. Considerably less accurate. And then it gets sharper. Open review comments allege the TurboQuant paper knowingly misrepresented RabbitQ's results. The RabbitQ authors filed a technical response. The explainer is honest. The paper it explains may not be. And yet, the explainer is arguably more valuable than the paper, because understanding the machinery of quantization, really understanding it with your fingers on the vectors, means you can evaluate these claims yourself. You can read the RabbitQ rebuttal and actually follow the math. This is the difference between education and marketing. Marketing needs you to trust the brand. Education gives you the tools to stop trusting and start verifying. Whoever built this page, codex or human or both, put the ladder where people can reach it. What they do once they climb is up to them. This one's been brewing quietly in browser land, and it just got real. A rogue JavaScript snippet on any website could quietly spin up an LLM inside your browser and start generating tokens on your hardware. One commenter pointed this out almost casually, like noticing a window left open in a bank vault. That's the prompt API. Google has shipped Gemini Nano directly into Chrome. Not as a download, not as a service call, but as a built-in capability of the browser itself. Any web developer can now call a language model the same way they'd call the clipboard, API, or request geolocation. Natural language processing as a browser primitive. The engineering is genuinely impressive. 22 gigs of free disk space, 4 gigs of VRAM or 16 of RAM. And you've got local inference with zero network dependency after the initial model download. No data leaves your machine, no API keys, no metered billing. For tasks like content classification, contact extraction, calendar parsing, the mundane connective tissue of the web. This is elegant. It works offline. It's free at the point of use. One developer already shipped it as a poor person's ALLAMA for lightweight tasks. And honestly, for that use case, it's hard to argue with. But here's the question nobody in the documentation is asking. What happens when the model layer of your application is controlled by the browser vendor? Google decides which model ships. Google decides when it updates. Google decides the 22 gigabyte storage threshold that triggers automatic deletion. You build your feature on Gemini Nano, and one Chrome update later, the behavior shifts beneath you. A commenter already noted that Gemma 4's smaller models outperform Nano. But you can't swap them in. The API is model agnostic in syntax and model locked in practice. This is the browser wars fought on new terrain. The capability is real and the privacy properties are genuinely good. Local inference as a web standard would be transformative, but a standard isn't a standard when one company controls the implementation. The W3C has no say over which weights Chrome bundles. The right version of this idea looks like a model agnostic inference API where developers bring their own weights. Where Gemma, Llama, Phi, or whatever ships next month can slot in. The API design work is solid. Dominic De Nicola, who led the design before retiring, published thoughtful considerations about the trade-offs involved. The interface is the gift. The lock-in is the catch. Local AI in the browser is a future. The question is whether it belongs to the web or to Chrome. We talked earlier about building in the open. Sometimes the bravest open source move is knowing when to walk away. In New Down Dong Yi, Linus Torvalds posted a message to comp.os.minix about a little operating system he was building. Quote, just a hobby, won't be big, be comprehensive. He was wrong about the outcome, but right about something deeper. The best things start as someone scratching their own itch, with no guarantee it goes anywhere. Rob Bowen built a Latvian noun conjugation quiz app. 84 possible word endings across 7 grammatical cases, 2 genders, 3 conjugation patterns. He built it, deployed it, and abandoned it the same day. And the piece he wrote about it is one of the most honest things I've read about what it actually means to build software for yourself. Here's what I want you to sit with. Latvian grammatical cases are a genuinely fascinating computational problem. Every noun mutates its ending based on its role in the sentence. Subject, object, indic, object, possession, location. Word order becomes irrelevant. The grammar itself is the data structure. Bowen saw that, and his developer brain did exactly what developer brains do. He reached for code. He built a quiz engine with spaced repetition, wrong answer limits, the whole thing. And then he shipped it and realized it didn't solve his actual problem. Run this forward. Every developer reading this has a graveyard of repositories. Half-built apps. Clever architectures nobody will ever see. Node_modules. Folders haunting old laptops. And the hustle culture narrative says those are failures. Always be shipping. Your GitHub graph is your resume. Interviewers measuring you by side project output as if learning only counts when it produces a deployable artifact. That framing is broken. The Latvian quiz app taught Bowen more about state management, data modeling, and his own learning patterns than finishing it ever would have. The code was the thinking tool, not the product. One commenter nailed it. On your side project, it's okay to ignore best engineering practice, reinvent the wheel, make decisions based on what seems most interesting. That's not failure, that's the workshop. The builder culture we should celebrate isn't measured in shipped products. It's measured in curiosity followed by action. The app that lives for one day and teaches you something real is worth more than the app that ships to indifference. Tinkering is the point. The repo doesn't need to survive. The builder does. Moving on. When I was designing a concurrent system last year, I hit a wall that every Rust developer eventually finds. The data structure I needed was a directed graph. Nodes pointing to other nodes, multiple edges converging on shared vertices. Ownership, singular and clean, doesn't map onto that topology. It's like trying to describe a river delta using a family tree. The structures are fundamentally different. This article lays out the two memory strategies Rust gives you: ownership with borrowing and reference counting. And it does so with unusual clarity. The key insight is that these aren't competing philosophies. They're different tools for different topologies. Ownership and borrowing is Rust's signature move. One owner per value. Compile time enforcement. Deterministic cleanup. The borrow checker guarantees aliasing XOR mutability. You can have many readers or one writer, never both. This eliminates use after free, iterator invalidation, and data erases before your code ever run. Zero runtime cost. The compiler does the work, so the CPU doesn't have to. But some structures resist single ownership. Graph shared configuration. Callbacks referencing surrounding state. For these, Rust provides RC and ART. Reference counting smart pointers that track how many handles point to a value and drop it when the count hits zero. Small runtime cost. Enormous ergonomic gain for shared ownership patterns. Think of it like architecture. Load-bearing walls handle most structural needs efficiently and predictably. But sometimes you need a flying buttress. A different engineering solution for a different force distribution. You wouldn't build an entire cathedral out of buttresses, and you wouldn't avoid them where the physics demands them. One commenter noted that Rust is becoming less special here. Languages like D and V are adding optional ownership. That's the point. Open designs propagate. Rust published the blueprints by existing as an open project. And now the entire ecosystem levels up. The pattern spreads because anyone can study it, adapt it, improve it. That's compounding knowledge in action. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for April 27th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go make something with your hands that your mind hasn't figured out yet. We'll see you back here tomorrow.